Executive Power, Disc 11.
President Hayes entered his office with a determined stride and an angry expression on his face. That on its own should have warned the Israeli ambassador that something bad was about to happen. But at that moment, someone other than the president had caught his attention. Actually, two people had, but the second one of the two was far more unsettling. Eitan had expected to see Secretary of State Berg, or Valerie Jones, or maybe even Michael Haake. He was mildly surprised to see CIA Director Kennedy, but it was the sight of her companion that literally made him slightly weak in the knees. He had read stories about the man, but they were nothing compared to the things he'd heard. Eitan had been told he was capable of great violence. Even the formidable head of Mossad, Ben Friedman, feared him. The ambassador had never seen him in person, only in photographs. His hair seemed longer now, and he was very tan. If it wasn't for the fact that he'd followed Kennedy into the room, he probably would have never known who it was. When the man turned and stared at Eitan with his dark brown eyes, all doubt vanished. Eitan had seen eyes like that before, and they didn't belong to diplomats. The ambassador quickly looked away and found the president standing before him. "Mr. President," Eitan started, his voice a bit shaky, "I am very sorry about the attack on your country this morning." Hayes stared back at the man, his suit coat unbuttoned and his hands on his hips, his eyes searching for the slightest sign of insincerity. "Mr. Ambassador, I'm short on time, so I'm going to make this real simple. I want your country to pull its military forces out of Hebron immediately." Eitan stood frozen before the president. He hadn't even been offered a seat, and he'd been given an ultimatum that he knew would not be accepted. He licked his lips and tried to temper his reply. "Mr. President, I will gladly forward your request, but I, of course, can make no guarantees." "First of all," replied Hayes, "it's not a request. It's a demand. And I want Prime Minister Goldberg to go on TV immediately to announce the withdrawal." The Israeli ambassador was reeling. "But, Mr. President, I cannot make such a request without..." Hayes held up his hand and stopped him from speaking further. "I know you want a concession, and it is this. In exchange for an immediate withdrawal, we will get the Security Council vote delayed until tomorrow." Eitan felt himself begin to sweat. This was not an offer that he could take to the Prime Minister. He knew what his job was, and despite being caught off guard, he gathered just enough confidence to hold his ground. "Mr. President, Prime Minister Goldberg will never agree to such a demand without assurances that you will veto the French resolution." The president shook his head vigorously. "If the troops aren't pulled out immediately, we will make no effort to delay the vote. In fact, if the troops aren't pulled out immediately, we will back the French resolution." All Eitan could think to do was shake his head. "I am afraid I will need more to work with, a concession of some sort." What Hayes had to offer was the opposite of what the ambassador was looking for. "Here's something to work with. Tell the Prime Minister that I know what really happened in Hebron. And unless he wants his cabinet to collapse in scandal, he'll announce an immediate withdrawal." The president turned to his left and said, "Mr. Rapp, if you would please show the ambassador across the hall to the Roosevelt room, we have it all set up for him to call Prime Minister Goldberg."
"I would like to go back to my embassy to make the call, sir."
The president testily replied, "I don't know if you've noticed, Mr. Ambassador, but we're running out of time. If you want me to forestall a vote on Palestinian statehood, I suggest you get the Prime Minister on the phone as soon as possible." Rapp stood up with one arm pointing toward the door. The message he conveyed was simple. The president was done talking. With a sigh and a nod, the ambassador reluctantly gave in. As Rapp escorted him from the room, the Israeli's discomfort was obvious.
Chapter 72. The president was reluctant to give final approval to the next part of Kennedy and Rapp's plan. If the media ever found out, they would eat him alive. Every leader of every country would scorn him, and virtually every member of his own party would repudiate him. As Rapp had pointed out, though, there was no other option. They were back downstairs in the Situation Room, just Kennedy and the president. Kennedy was resting the phone against her shoulder, waiting for the president to answer her question. She could tell he was having second thoughts.
"Sir, this will not hurt you,"
This was my idea, and I gave the order. Mitch has already laid out plausible deniability. We have a source in place, and after what happened this morning, no one will be able to criticize us for being overly cautious. Kennedy waited for a few seconds and then added, "Both our ambassador and the French ambassador are out of the building. Now is the time, sir." There was no other option. The French were refusing to delay the vote, and Rapp insisted they not reveal what they knew about Ambassador Jussard until the time was right. That was ammunition they would use later. Ultimately, the decision came down to trust. Hayes trusted Kennedy and Rapp, and in addition to that, they were out of options. Hayes looked at the director of the CIA and said, "Go ahead." Kennedy punched in the number, and when the familiar voice of her counterterrorism director answered, she said, "Jake, that phone call we talked about earlier, it's time to make it." Kennedy listened only long enough to receive confirmation, and then hung up. Roosevelt Room, his back against the wall and his hands firmly clasped in front of him. Normally he enjoyed being as anonymous as possible, but this morning he rather relished playing the role of intimidator. He'd even gone so far as to wait in the conference room alone with the ambassador until the Israeli had been forced to ask him to leave. His injury was considerably better, and despite not having slept much the night before, he felt okay. This was because they were finally making some progress, taking action and forcing people to do things that would tell them more about where they stood. Sitting back and waiting for things to happen was contrary to Rapp's way of life. He was about to open the door and rattle the ambassador again when his digital phone began to vibrate. Rapp snatched it from his belt and checked the number before answering the call. It was the CTC.
"Hello. Mitch, you're not going to believe what I'm looking at."
It was Olivia Bourne, and her voice was elated.
"I've got our mystery boy on camera. He just checked in at the United counter at BWI.
"Baltimore, Washington International?" Rapp's voice was eager.
"You're sure it's him?" "The computer picked him up first. It's been running searches all morning at Reagan, Dulles, BWI, Union Station, and Richmond."
The facial recognition program that Bourne was referring to was able to scan hundreds of images every second and instantaneously compare them against a sample, which in this case was the earlier photograph of John Doe they had from his entry into the country.
"It's him, Mitch, and if you hold on for a second, I'll give you a name and an itinerary."
Rapp's mind was already racing ahead.
"Have you told anyone?" "Only Marcus. He's working on a name and flight right now."
"Is he still at the counter?"
"No, he's just walked away. But we have him on camera. He's headed toward the security line. Hold on. Marcus has a name. Don Marin. He's booked on a flight that leaves for Paris at 10:32, and from there it looks like he's connecting to Nice."
The frantic calculations and maneuvering came to an abrupt halt.
"Say that again," commanded Rapp.
Even as Bourne repeated herself, Rapp barely paid attention. His mind was already off, looking in a different direction toward Europe. He was no longer frantically trying to figure out how to get to the Baltimore airport in 30 minutes. He was no longer trying to figure out how to deal with the airport police and the FBI and everybody else who would want to get their hands on the man who had more than likely killed both the Palestinian and Saudi ambassadors. He was suddenly seeing things with great clarity.
"How are the cameras at BWI?"
he finally asked.
"Good."
"Good enough to make sure he gets on that flight?"
There was a pause while Bourne did some checking. "I've just pulled up his gate, and they're already boarding the plane. I don't think he has enough time to do anything other than go straight to the gate.
But if he's got another ticket and another flight..."
"I'll keep an eye on him and make sure he gets on the one to Paris."
Rapp stood calmly in the hallway, clutching the tiny phone to his left ear. If this went wrong, he would be severely criticized for not alerting the airport police and having John Doe arrested. If he did that, however, there would be a record and a lot of witnesses. And even if he did manage to get the guy away from the police and the FBI, he would have to try to interrogate him, which Rapp detested. There was a better way, a little bit riskier, but in the end, a way that was much more likely to give them the truth. Bourne's voice pulled him back to the moment.
"What do you want me to do?"
Rapp didn't speak at first, and then he said,
Keep an eye on him. Make sure he gets on that flight and get me a surveillance team and a plane.
Bourne did not reply right away and then asked,
Are you sure you don't want to alert the FBI and have him detained?
No, he wasn't sure, but he was pretty sure, and if his luck held for another 30 minutes, he'd be absolutely sure.
Let's keep the feds out of this for now. Just don't lose him, and get me a plane.
Rapp stabbed the end button and then quickly dialed a number from memory. After several rings, Scott Coleman answered, and Rapp asked,
Can you and the boys be ready to leave within the hour?
May I ask where we're going?
South of France. Low intensity, mostly surveillance, but I might need you guys if I have to do any heavy lifting.
Standard fee?
Asked the retired SEAL.
Of course. We're in.
Rapp was already on his way downstairs. Good. I'll call with the specifics. In the meantime, get ready to roll.
With her finger poised above the keypad of the secure phone, Kennedy looked to the president and asked,
Are you ready?
Hayes nodded and placed his hand near his own phone. Kennedy dialed the number from memory, and after she'd hit the last number, she gestured for the president to pick up. The voice that answered on the other end was not Ben Friedman's. It was one of his assistants who politely informed Kennedy that Friedman was on the phone. Kennedy didn't doubt that. The Director General of Mossad was undoubtedly talking to Prime Minister Goldberg about the phone call he'd just received from his ambassador in Washington. Kennedy told the assistant that it was very important that she talk to Friedman and that she would wait. It didn't take more than a minute for Friedman to come on the line, and when he did, his voice was cautious.
Irene, how are you?
Fine, Ben, and you?
I have been better, much better.
I would imagine so. Have you heard about our meeting with your ambassador?
Yes. The unfortunate development was just relayed to me.
Ben, I'm calling you as a favor, one old friend to another. The president is very serious about this. He wants those tanks out of Hebron immediately.
So I've heard, was all Friedman managed to say.
Kennedy knew he was not about to freely offer information.
That's not all the president wants, Ben.
With a tired sigh, Friedman asked,
What else does he want?
Your job, Kennedy replied flatly. He wants you removed as head of Mossad immediately.
That is ludicrous. Why would he demand such a thing, much less care who runs Mossad?
He knows you lied to us about Hebron, and allies don't lie to each other about things like that.
Kennedy looked at Hayes while silence filled the line. She knew Friedman was trying to think of some excuse for deceiving them.
Ben, I'm sure you had your reasons, but now is the time to come clean. If you care about keeping your job and keeping our alliance together, you'll tell me.
Friedman snorted.
David Goldberg is not about to start taking orders from anyone, even the President of the United States.
Really, replied Kennedy. Sensing Friedman's confidence was feigned, she said, Even if it meant ending his career in political scandal? I'm not judging you for what happened in Hebron. God only knows how we'd react if we had suicide bombs going off every week. But you need to keep me in the loop, Ben.
What do you know about Hebron?
No, Ben, Kennedy forcefully announced. That's not the way we're going to do this. If you want to keep your job, and you want to avoid this scandal becoming public, you're going to answer the questions. The president is furious, Ben. Those were Apache helicopters and Hellfire missiles.
She lowered her voice as if she didn't want to be overheard and said, We have satellite footage of the attacks. The president wants to take the tapes to the UN and show the world that you and Goldberg are liars. Seconds ticked by before anything was said, and then finally Friedman spoke. He had no other choice than to admit the truth.
There was no bomb factory.
Why didn't you tell me that from the start?
I'm sorry. I should have.
The apology did not come easily. Why the cover story? Asked Kennedy.
Because I wasn't going to miss the chance to take every last one of those bastards out. But with them meeting in a neighborhood like that, I knew they would claim a massacre.
How did you find out about the meeting?
We had a source.
Who?
Asked Kennedy in a casual tone.
Someone who was working for us.
Kennedy looked at the president for a second.
Who was the source?
I can't tell you that.
Ben, we're on the same side on this. Trust me, I need you to tell me who your source was.
Friedman was reluctant and then said,
A Palestinian.
Was he on your payroll?
No.
Did you recruit him or did he come to you?
A little bit of both, I suppose.
Kennedy had no idea whether or not this source of Friedman's was an important piece of the puzzle, but intuition and experience told her to dig deeper.
Ben, if you want me to convince the president to back off, I need you to send Jake Turbis everything you have on this Palestinian, and I need it immediately.
For good measure, she decided to add, the president is meeting with the Secretary of State right now. They are discussing how to bring the Hebron evidence in front of the UN.
Friedman tried to figure out what Kennedy was after. His Palestinian informant was dead, along with all the other terrorists. He saw no harm in sending her the encrypted files on him, but instinct told him there was more going on here than he was aware of. One thing he did know, however, was that a great deal of damage would be done if the UN was told the truth about Hebron. After thinking about it for a good 10 seconds, and seeing no better alternative, he agreed to send the information.
Chapter 73. It wasn't easy, but Rapp waited until their man had boarded the plane. He owed both Bourne and Dumond for not bolting on him and setting off the alarms that would have led to a 3-ring circus at Baltimore Washington International. To stop the flight and detain their John Doe would have meant alerting the airline, the control tower, the airport police, the FBI, and God only knew who else. The odds were very high that someone on that long list would call the media and alert them to something strange at BWI. Any one of the 24-hour news outlets, or all of them, were likely to show up and shoot footage of the inevitable FBI SWAT team in full gear hauling a man in a business suit off an international flight. It was no criticism of the FBI. They had their job, and Rapp had his. It was just that Rapp's job was always done best when it was carried out as far away from the media as possible. As he approached the soundproof door to the Situation Room, he paused for just a second. The president and Kennedy did not need to know he'd been on the phone making arrangements. Rapp opened the door and found President Hayes, Kennedy, Secretary of State Berg, Chief of Staff Jones, and NSA Hake all watching the bank of television sets and talking on various phones. The news was out that there was a bomb threat at the UN. People were streaming out of the bland Orwellian building in droves as police cruisers set up makeshift roadblocks to keep any vehicle from getting within 2 blocks of the world headquarters. Rapp took a second to admire his handiwork. It had been his idea to phone in the threat. He approached Kennedy and bent over to whisper in her ear,
"Our John Doe just got on a flight bound for Paris."
Kennedy turned her chair so she could look Rapp in the eye. It was as if she had to make sure he wasn't kidding before she'd believe it. She told the person on the phone that she had to go and hung up the phone. Reaching over, she grabbed the president's arm and, in a voice loud enough so only he could hear, she leaned in and repeated the news to Hayes. Rapp placed a hand on the back of Kennedy's chair and bent over to listen. Before the president could react to the news, Rapp took a knee and said, "Sir, this is what I propose we do. The flight is headed to Paris and then on to Nice, where I assume our guy will be meeting Omar, whose yacht is still docked in Cannes. I can have a team in the air in less than an hour. We can get there before he lands and have everything set up." Hayes looked at Kennedy, who only shrugged her shoulders.
"What about the French?"
"What about them?" asked Rapp. The president had been thinking about how best to use the information to forestall the vote, and now seemed like a good time. "I think we need to bring them in on this." Rapp's expression turned from hopeful to hopeless. Never one to sugarcoat things, he said, "I think that's a bad idea, sir."
"Listen," replied Hayes, a bit testily, "the French are not going to roll over on this thing. As soon as the UN opens tomorrow morning, they're going to convene the Security Council, and they're going to put this to a vote, and I'm not going to be able to veto it."
"Why not?" asked a defiant Rapp.
"For starters, because I actually do think the Palestinians should have a state."
Hayes firmly placed his forefinger in the palm of his hand.
"And secondly, because Crown Prince Faisal has asked me to."
Hayes ticked off his point by adding a second finger.
"And in light of what happened to his cousin just a short while ago, I'm inclined to grant his request."
Rapp began ticking off his counterpoints, every bit as determined as the president was. "We're talking about the same Crown Prince whose brother bribed the French ambassador with $1 million.
We're talking about the same crown prince whose brother has been meeting with some guy who just mysteriously shows up whenever someone is killed.
The president interrupted. I know Faisal personally, and I can guarantee that he had nothing to do with this.
Can you? Asked a doubtful rap, and then, in a more conciliatory tone, added, I happen to agree that Faisal doesn't have a hand in this, but I'd sure as hell like to make sure before we lay what little we know on the table.
I would too, but we don't have time, the president said in frustration. If we're going to get the French to change their minds, we need to open a dialogue now. Secretary of State Berg wants to present the evidence of Ambassador Jussard's bribe to the foreign minister as soon as possible. She's confident that once they see the evidence, they will recall the ambassador immediately.
Rapp's displeasure was obvious. Sir, the moment we do that, we've tipped our hand. People will be warned. Someone will alert Omar and he'll fly the coop like that.
Rapp snapped his fingers.
He'll go back to Saudi Arabia and we'll never get our hands on him and we'll never know how far-reaching this thing was.
What if we have the French pick up this John Doe when he lands in Paris? We can have our people from the FBI present during the interrogation.
Rapp's eyes were closed and he was shaking his head vehemently. Sir, if we do that, we'll never learn the whole truth, and what little we do learn will take weeks, if not months, to extract from this guy, and that still doesn't solve Omar. I'm telling you, the second we grab this guy, we risk tipping off Omar, and without more evidence, no one is going to lay a hand on Omar.
Hayes sighed.
So, what do you propose we do?
Give me 12 hours, sir. That's all I'm asking. I've got a team ready to go. We can get to Nice before John Doe arrives and shadow him every step of the way.
And what if you come up empty?
Rapp could tell the president was leaning in his favor. We're no worse off than we are right now.
Except that we're up against the clock with the French.
Rapp swore under his breath. Sir, if I were you, I wouldn't tell the French a thing. I'd wait until that smug bastard Jussard climbs up on his high horse tomorrow morning. And then I'd have Secretary Berg ask him what he thinks of bribery. After he gets done stammering, the secretary can clobber him over the head with the evidence. The resolution will never make it to a vote, and if it does by some off chance, we can veto it in good conscience until a full investigation is made into Jussard's finances, and if the Crown Prince is upset, you can ask him what his brother is doing giving $1 million to the French ambassador to the UN.
The president actually laughed.
That would be enjoyable. But the French are our allies, and I don't think we can blindside them like that.
Rapp was tempted to comment on the value of having allies like the French, but he decided not to. He could tell the president was leaning in his favor.
12 hours, sir. That's all I'm asking. Have I ever disappointed you?
The president was out of arguments. He looked to Kennedy for her opinion, and she nodded.
All right, Hayes said, turning back to Rapp. You have 12 hours.
Chapter 74. David had found the long flight from America relaxing. He'd reclined in his first-class seat and ignored the in-flight movie. It was a drama, and he wasn't in the mood for it. Maybe a comedy would have grabbed his attention, but definitely not a drama. What he needed was an escape from the harsh reality of what he'd been doing. David did not enjoy murdering, but he understood it as a necessary evil in a world where it was often the only way to get things done. Thousands upon thousands of lives had been ended in the quest for Palestinian independence. What would a few more matter? None of this was new to him. He'd known it from an early age. He had seen his path in life, knowing that someday he would have a hand in shaping the birth of his nation. And now that his dream was so close, the guilt disappeared in the hum of jet engines. At 45,000 feet, somewhere over the vast Atlantic Ocean, he tucked a thin blue blanket up under his chin and thought of Palestine, warm thoughts of a nation at peace. And then he fell asleep. He'd landed in Paris and changed flights without incident. The first sign that something had gone wrong was when he landed in Nice and caught a news update on the television. He'd been incommunicado for the better part of 7 hours and was starved for information. The vote had not taken place.
the UN had been shut down due to a bomb threat. David's eyes squinted at the television and instantly knew the bomb scare was a ruse. Angry but under control, he headed off in search of answers. Unfortunately, those answers would have to come from Omar. As promised, a limousine was waiting for him at the curb. David climbed into the back seat and settled in for the short ride down the coast. He was entirely oblivious to the fact that he was being watched. Rapp stood at the window of his hotel room. The lights were off, and he was careful to stand a few feet back from the glass. Before leaving the States, he'd honored his new agreement with his wife and told her the destination and likely duration of his trip. She wanted to know if his sudden departure had anything to do with the car bomb, and after a slight hesitation, he told her that it did. All in all, he was surprised how well the conversation had gone. Rapp pressed a pair of high-powered binoculars to his face and looked down on the harbor of Cannes in the south of France. The Albert Eduardo Pier stretched out before him. Some of the world's finest yachts were berthed for the night, crowded together with barely a foot to spare between each, all neatly tucked in. As grand and opulent as all the other vessels were, one stood out above the rest. Actually, it towered above the rest. Rapp had seen wealth before. He'd traveled the world and visited many cities, most of them port cities, but he had never seen a non-commercial or military vessel as large as Omar's yacht. The massive ship was moored at the end of the pier. No individual slip was big enough to hold it. Omar's yacht was easily twice as large as the next biggest vessel, which was no small thing when one considered that it was parked in a harbor that was known as the ultimate playground for the world's wealthy. Rapp had never met Omar, and until this week had only heard of him in passing. He suddenly had a great desire to meet this corpulent Saudi prince. The signs were easy enough to recognize. Rapp had seen them before. He knew how to analyze himself better than any shrink. He would like to put the prince on the other end of his gun and watch him squirm. Men like Omar were never humiliated. That was their biggest problem. They went through life with a very warped sense of reality. Their own lives took on an over-exaggerated sense of importance, while virtually everyone else around them became trivial, expendable, small. His yacht symbolized how Omar perceived himself. He was his ship, the biggest and thus most important. Everyone else was secondary. Only his desires were what mattered. It was approaching midnight. Rapp and his team had arrived 2 hours ago and were in the process of calibrating all of their equipment to make sure it worked perfectly. They didn't need much. The British surveillance team that had been in place since Monday was on top of things. They briefed Rapp thoroughly, and as always, their cooperation was excellent. Rapp had worked with the folks from MI6 before and had found them to be extremely good at their jobs. In addition to what the Brits already had in place and their own directional microphones, Scott Coleman had just finished placing listening devices on the hull of the yacht. Rapp looked through the binoculars at the small sailboat and watched as Coleman handed his scuba tank to one of his men and climbed aboard. The British sailboat was tied up 2 jetties over from Omar's yacht and was partially blocked by a sizable cabin cruiser. When Coleman was finally back on board the sailboat, Rapp relaxed a bit. Everything was in place. Their guy had landed. He was no longer John Doe. With the delivery of the encrypted file from Mossad, Kennedy had put a name with a face. He was Jabril Khattabi, the Palestinian who had given Mossad the intelligence boon that had turned into a massacre. The man who had started it all. A man who interested Rapp greatly. On the flight over, Rapp had read every scrap of Jabril's file, and the more he read, the more interested he became. On the face of it, this Jabril did not seem like a pawn. Marcus Dumond had plunged into his financials and so far had discovered a personal fortune in excess of $5 million, almost all of it in highly liquid assets. He had been educated at the very bosom of American agnostic liberalism, the University of California at Berkeley. He'd gone to work for a venture capital firm in Silicon Valley after college and had traveled the world, focusing mostly on investments from Arab oil people. Everything in his file pointed not to terrorism, but to capitalism. If it weren't for the audio surveillance they had of his meetings with Omar and the fact he'd been a Mossad informant, Rapp would have sworn the man was nothing more than one of Omar's abundant financial advisers. He found it hard to believe this wealthy man from a well-educated family was a terrorist. But the evidence was conclusive. Before the night was over, Rapp was hoping to have a little chat with the Palestinian to see if he could clear a few things up. They didn't have much time. The president's deadline was firm. Every time Rapp had talked to Kennedy, she'd reminded him of that. Things in Washington had grown even more hectic since he'd left. Neither the French nor the Palestinians had been placated by Israel's withdrawal from Hebron. The Israelis now claimed incontrovertible evidence that there had been a bomb factory in Hebron, and they were prepared to present that evidence before an international board of inquiry. The evidence, of course, had been planted during the military occupation of the town in order to save Prime Minister Goldberg from a controversy that would spell the end of his government. The French ambassador to the UN had privately confronted the American ambassador and accused the CIA of doing exactly what they'd done, phoning in a bomb scare in order to delay the vote on Palestinian statehood. Ambassador Jussar was offended and indignant that the world's lone superpower would stoop so low. Even though he was right, it was rather amusing that the condemnation was coming from a man who'd been bribed into putting forth a resolution that was causing so much consternation in the first place. Israel was offering to sit down and discuss peace with the Palestinians as soon as the Palestinians honored a ceasefire agreement. The Palestinians, for their part, refused to abide by a ceasefire agreement until they had it in writing that Prime Minister Goldberg would close and relocate every Jewish settlement in the West Bank. Prime Minister Goldberg flat out refused such a request, and the violence continued. Both the Russians and the Chinese were suspicious about the timing of the bomb scare that shut down the UN, and both were vowing to make sure the French resolution was voted on first thing in the morning. The president was getting a great deal of pressure from the Secretary of State and his chief of staff to bring the French into the fold on the entire matter. Rapp had just spoken to Kennedy on the secure satellite phone, and she had reassured him that although the president was tempted, he was going to honor his commitment of 12 hours. Chapter 75. David tipped the driver and declined the man's offer to carry his lone bag to the yacht. He stood for a long moment at the beginning of the pier and looked toward the hulking white ship. It seemed as if all of his strength and energy were being sucked from him. He did not look forward to seeing Omar. He desperately wanted information. He just wished there was a way to get it without having to sit down for a royal audience. Reluctantly, he put one foot in front of the other and started for the white yacht. He was barely halfway there when he spotted Devon LeClaire standing in the open gangway at the side of the ship. High above, on the bridge, David could see men in white uniforms moving about. He knew from previous visits that the ship was always more active at night. That was when Omar entertained, when he held his hedonistic parties after he'd returned from the discos and the casinos. The casinos in Cannes didn't even open until 8 in the evening. The high rollers like Omar rarely showed up before midnight. David secretly hoped Omar was gone, and Devon could tell him what was going on, but he doubted he would be so lucky. Omar would want to hear all the details of his trip to America, especially the car bomb in Washington. That had been Omar's idea. At first, David had said no. There were too many things that could go wrong, too many innocent bystanders who could be hurt. Omar persisted, though. He'd badgered him for months and had thrown larger and larger amounts of money at him. He threatened to pull out of the entire operation and send David packing. He pointed out that the brutal murder of the Saudi ambassador would put the crown prince in a position of sympathy. Omar explained that he had been preaching to his brother for years to stand up to the Americans and that when the time was right he would be there in his ear telling him what to ask of the Americans when they apologized for the shocking international incident that had taken place on their soil. Everything hinged on the Americans. They had the veto power, and they alone could stand in the way of the creation of a Palestinian state. Omar explained that international pressure wasn't enough. They needed economic pressure on their side, and they needed the American president to feel guilty over the death of Crown Prince Faisal's favorite cousin. It wasn't enough to simply show the world once again that Israel was run by thugs. The world already knew that. Killing the Palestinian ambassador would rally the UN to their cause, but would it be enough pressure to forestall a veto by the United States? Possibly not. David didn't like the idea of putting so much into his plan and coming up short. Omar was right, and like everything else in his princely life, he eventually got his way. As he approached the gangplank, he asked himself again what could have possibly gone wrong. They had thought of everything, but somehow the Americans had delayed the vote. He forced himself to smile at Devon. "Good evening."
"You look tired," was all the Frenchman said in response.
"Thank you," replied David with feigned sincerity. "And you look marvelous, as always." Devon frowned at him from behind his glasses.
"The prince is waiting for you in his private salon."
David nodded and stepped into the ship.
"Leave your bag, and I'll have someone put it in the stateroom. I assume you're staying the night."
"I suppose." David dropped his bag and headed down the passageway in search of his benefactor. When he reached the lavishly decorated private salon, he was pleasantly surprised to find only Omar and his ever-present bodyguard, Chung. This was where Omar usually entertained the call girls and prostitutes that he kept around for his perverse sexual pleasures. As with almost everything Omar commissioned, the room was overdone. Too many pillows, too many Persian rugs on the floor, too many silk panels on the walls, and too much chiffon draped from the ceiling. The place looked like some kind of a cross between a desert harem and a whorehouse, which, on second thought, was probably exactly the look Omar was after. Before David got far, Chung stepped forward, his eyes checking out the assassin from head to toe. David opened his suit coat and did a 360 so Chung could see that he was unarmed. It amused him slightly that Chung had stopped frisking him. It would have been very easy to hide a small-caliber pistol in the waistband of his underwear. There had been times lately where the thought had crossed David's mind. Omar disgusted him more and more. David knew what his own cause was, but with Omar it wasn't so clear. At first the prince had espoused with great passion his belief that there was no more important Arab cause than Palestinian statehood. David had listened to Omar speak glowingly of his commitment to the Palestinian cause, and David had believed every word of it. That had been more than 2 years ago. And since then he had learned a great deal. First and foremost, he'd learned that Omar didn't really care for anything other than his own pleasure. And sometimes his own pleasure involved watching other people suffer. Omar's feigned love of Palestine was the thin outer veneer of a sadistic hatred of Israel. Where David dreamt of a free Palestinian state as an end, Omar dreamt of a free Palestinian state as the beginning of an end, the end of Israel. In an unusual gesture, Omar stood. He not only stood, but he smiled. He held out his arms like he was a father greeting his favorite son. Before David knew it, he was being pulled in. It was part of the other side of Omar. His mood was infectious, whether he was up or down. He brought everybody with him like the tide. Right now he was up, and David couldn't help but grin.
"Come here," Omar's voice bellowed. "You have succeeded."
David allowed himself to be hugged, even though he didn't feel like he'd succeeded.
"You have done marvelously," roared Omar as he patted David on the back. "Have you seen the tape?" asked Omar as he released him.
"No, I've been on a plane all day. I have no idea what's happened. What is this I hear about a bomb threat at the UN? Omar deflected the question with a flip of his wrist.
"That is nothing. Only a delayed tactic by the Americans. Come, you must see the videotape."
Omar forced David over to a chair in front of a large plasma TV.
"Sit, sit, I command you. When we are done, we will go to the casino and then the discotheque for some women."
David reluctantly dropped into the chair and watched as Omar picked up a remote control. "What is going on at the UN? Why didn't they vote?"
"There was some bomb scare, but do not worry. The vote is going to take place first thing in the morning and it is going to pass."
David eyed Omar suspiciously. "How do you know it will pass?"
"I just talked with my brother. I've been talking to that poor excuse for a man all day. I think he actually cried when he found out Abdul had been blown up."
Omar stopped fiddling with the remote for a second and looked at David with his most incredulous expression.
Can you believe that a grown man would cry over such a thing? My brother is a fool.
David was sure that somewhere, in some very thick medical reference book, there was a term that described Omar's personality. But he had yet to take the time to sit down and look it up. Ignoring his obsession with his brother, the Crown Prince, David repeated his question. How can you be so sure it will pass tomorrow?
My brother, the weak fool, has been given assurances by all of the permanent members that they will vote in favor of the resolution.
Even the United States?
They have not given their word yet, but they have no choice. As we discussed, I convinced my brother that now was the time for the threat of an all-out embargo.
Omar smiled and said,
After you killed Abdul, the president asked my brother if there was anything he could do, and my brother told him to vote for the French resolution.
Omar began laughing so hard, he actually began to shake. After he'd calmed a bit, he added,
They are all such idiots.
All David could think to do was nod and smile. When the tape was finally rewound, Omar hit play and said,
You will not believe this. A film crew showed up just minutes after the explosion.
David watched as the screen went from black to black and gray, and then, finally, a shot of people running down a sidewalk. In the distance was a cloud of smoke. Most of the people were running away from the smoke, but the cameraman and several other people were running toward it. David began to feel himself sweat. He shifted uncomfortably in the chair. He had no desire to watch this, but he could feel Omar's eyes on him. Suddenly, there were people on the ground. The camera stopped at each one for a few seconds, cataloging the tragedy, and then the reporter began shouting instructions. The lens came up, and the horizon was filled with smoke and the twisted, burning wreckage of cars. David looked away and found Omar standing only a few feet away watching him.
You don't like this?
He asked with a gleam in his eye. David managed to keep his voice calm. I know what I did. I do not need to watch it.
Oh, but you do.
Omar walked closer to the TV. With one hand he gestured toward David and with the other toward the large screen.
This is your work. This is what you have accomplished. You should be proud of it.
Omar was smiling widely now. And it occurred to David that he was probably taping this for his voyeuristic collection. I am proud of what I did. David lied. He was proud of what he did in Jordan. He was proud of what he did with the Hattaché cases in Hebron. And he was even proud of what he did in New York. But this carnage that he was watching on TV, he was not proud of.
Tell me, said Omar excitedly, do you think my cousin survived the initial blast?
The screen was now filled with images of a breached and burning limousine.
I hope he did, that American-loving bastard. Look closely. I think that is someone's leg.
Omar paused the tape and looked at his assassin for an answer. David shook his head. He'd had enough. My prince, I'm sorry, but I have no desire to watch this. It took David only a split second to realize something was wrong, but by then it was too late. Omar was still smiling at him and watching him closely, when suddenly he looked just beyond David and gave a signal. Before David could react, something was around his neck and he was yanked backward. His hands immediately shot up and his fingers desperately tried to get under the rope that was choking him. Omar was suddenly before him.
I have enjoyed corrupting you.
His gloating face was only several feet away.
Your intentions were so pure, and look at the great destruction you've caused.
Omar turned and pointed to the TV. David gave up on trying to get his fingers under the rope and reached back for Chung's head. He found a fistful of hair with one hand and began searching for an eye with the other. Omar enjoyed the struggle.
You should have known better than to trust me. You, of all people.
Omar shook his head like he was admonishing a child.
You always preached to me about security. You were the one who told me not to talk to anyone about our plans.
The smile suddenly vanished from Omar's face, and he leaned in close.
And you always kept asking for more money.
David couldn't get a hold of an eye. Chung was too strong. He began to realize that this was a fight he would not win. Specks of light started to appear on the periphery of his vision, and his lungs began to ache. Suddenly, Omar was very close to him, saying something that he didn't bother to try to understand. His brain was too preoccupied with finding more oxygen. He could feel himself slipping away, and his thoughts turned to the memories of his youth, to Jerusalem, and to his family. As his body began to relax into death, he was comforted by the vision of his mother caring for the sick. Rapp slowly removed his headphones and tossed them on the bed. He didn't leave the window at first. He just stood there like a hawk perched on a tall branch, looking down at the large white vessel. Some stubborn sense of fairness in him did not like what had just transpired, but there wasn't much he could have done about it. He tried his best to not let it bother him, but it did. And he could tell it bothered the other people in the room, too. No one spoke for at least a minute. Finally, Rapp turned to the others and said, "Pack everything up. I want to be out of here in 15 minutes." The team of technicians were already at work. One of them was in the process of sending the encrypted audio back to Langley, while a second had begun packing the equipment. The third had hacked into the hotel's network and was placing a worm to erase all security footage from the time they'd arrived until 30 minutes from now. Before leaving, Rapp looked back out at the harbor one more time, at Omar's massive yacht and the limousine that was still parked at the entrance to the pier. The president would get all the evidence he needed, and then some. Rapp had killed many times and could honestly say he'd never enjoyed it, or, at the very least, he'd never relished it. Yes, there'd been times where he'd felt just satisfaction in killing someone who deserved it, but that was about the extent of it. Pensively, he turned away from the window with the expression of a man who was lost in thought. He put on his suit coat over his holstered 9mm Beretta and started for the door. He paused on the threshold and looked back at the three analysts. "Good job. I'll see you at the plane." Rapp walked past the elevators to the stairs and started down. Raising his digitally encrypted radio to his mouth, he said, "Scott, I'm coming down. Meet me by the east entrance of the hotel with the car." Chapter 76. Omar was in a hurry to join in the revelry. He'd kicked everyone off the yacht so he could have his private meeting with David, and with that little piece of business taken care of, he was ready to enjoy the evening. His cousins had gone ahead to the casino club to try to procure some women for the trip to Saint-Tropez in the morning. He would much prefer it if they could find some young, aspiring actress to join them, rather than the usual whores they had to pay for. The young ones were so much fun to corrupt. Omar had lent large amounts of money to Italian, French, and American producers over the years, and the walls of the ship's upper gallery were adorned with autographed headshots of the silver screen's elite. The photos never failed to impress the naive teenagers. The size of the yacht, the opulence of the furnishings, the photographs, they overwhelmed the vulnerable young women. And if that wasn't enough, there was a full complement of drugs that could be used either overtly or surreptitiously to melt away their inhibitions. Omar stepped from his yacht onto the pier. It was a clear night, and the fresh air of the Mediterranean felt wonderful. Killing David had livened his senses. He couldn't wait for the rest of the evening's entertainment. His cousins would immensely enjoy watching the tape of Chung strangling the insolent Palestinian. None of them liked him. Omar had been very fond of David at first, but his impudent attitude had worn thin. His disapproving looks and his refusal to join in the sexual merriment became increasingly intolerable. He was only a Palestinian, after all, and his place in the pecking order of the Arab tribes was at the very bottom. The fact that he didn't know his place in society and that he kept asking for more money was what had made the decision easy. Besides, Omar would sleep much easier knowing that David would not be telling or selling his secrets to the wrong party. Rapp watched the portly Arab waddle down the pier in his shiny suit. His mountainous Chinese bodyguard walked in front of him, his head turning and his eyes deliberately sweeping the path before them like a spotlight atop a citadel searching for danger. Rapp had read the British surveillance reports, probing for a weakness. The boat would have been difficult. Too many people and almost no set schedule. Someone was always up and moving about. There was the bathroom at the casino, and there was the party room at the hotel. There were all kinds of options that if Rapp absolutely had to, he could have made work. But he was short on time, and forcing something often led to mistakes. In Rapp's line of work, mistakes could get someone other than the target killed, or, at a bare minimum, cause an international crisis. Fortunately, one very straightforward opportunity jumped off the page at him. Rapp was not acting without orders. The president didn't know what he was about to do, but that had been intentional. In operations such as this, it was best to insulate the president and the office from any blame. Rapp and Kennedy had decided it was time to send a message to the Saudis. No longer would they have free rein in financing terrorism as if it were some hobby to be enjoyed in one's spare time. Through his earpiece, he could hear the operational chatter of Scott Coleman receiving updates from the other men. It was nothing more than background noise for Rapp. He could clearly see Omar and Chung from where he was stationed. The others were there as backup to monitor the local police frequencies and finish the job if for some reason Rapp fell short, which he had absolutely no intention of doing. Chung reached the limousine first. Even though the casino was only a few short blocks away, Devon LeClaire kept a limousine on 24-hour standby. It was enough of an exertion for the prince to amble the length of the pier. He was not about to walk down the sidewalk to the casino. Before opening the door, Chung took one last look around, giving a group of youths across the street a long, hard stare. Then, when Prince Omar was ready, Chung opened the door for his employer and helped him into the vehicle. Chung then somehow managed to fold his frame in half and squeeze into the dark back seat, closing the door behind him. The first bullet struck him in the face. So did the second. The silencer on the tip of the gun minimized the muzzle flash to barely a spark. Chung never moved other than the slight jerking motion his head made as each hollow point round penetrated his forehead. He sat motionless like some ancient stone statue, his posture upright and his hands open and resting on his knees. He never had even a fraction of a second to realize something was wrong. All in all, it wasn't a bad way to die. Omar would not be so fortunate. The door locks on the limo clicked simultaneously, and the vehicle began to move. Omar reached for an overhead reading light and pressed it. A narrow beam of light shone down on him, and he looked around nervously. Something strange was happening. There had been several unusual noises, a few weak sparks, but the usually alert Chung was sitting still, unalarmed. Somewhere near the front of the compartment there was movement, and Omar suddenly realized someone else was in the car. The danger of the situation still had yet to register as he asked, "Who is there?" Rapp, who was dressed in black, blended in perfectly with the dark interior and heavily smoked windows of the limousine. He leaned forward and, in Arabic, said, "I am a friend of your brother's." His words were carefully chosen. Omar's eyes opened wide and his right arm reached for Chung. It was at that moment that he realized something was seriously wrong. He pushed Chung and the Asian man's lifeless body fell sideways into the door. Turning back to his assailant with panic in his voice, he asked, "Who are you?" "I am your executioner," Rapp answered, again in Arabic. Omar, thinking the assailant in his car was a Saudi, said, "You cannot harm me. I am a member of the royal family." Rapp smiled and changed to English. "I am an American, and as a favor to your brother, I am going to kill you." Omar's eyes grew even larger. He was shocked by the man's change of languages. "For what?" he croaked incredulously. "I have done nothing but honor my brother." "You are a liar, and you have disgraced your family." Rapp again chose his words very carefully, for every second of this was being recorded. "I have done no such thing," stammered an unconvincing Omar. Rapp looked back at him, leaving no doubt that he didn't believe a single word the man uttered. "You had your own cousin, Abdul bin Aziz, killed."
"I did no such thing."
"And I suppose you never called your brother a fool and a poor excuse for a man?" The quote struck a note of familiarity with Omar, and his expression changed in a very subtle way. "I love my brother. I do not always agree with him, but I love him."
Do you love him enough to admit that you had your own cousin killed?
I did no such thing.
Rapp squeezed his left index finger, and a 9mm round spat from the end of the silencer, striking Omar in the knee. The Saudi prince lurched forward and screamed in agony. In all of his pampered life, he had never felt anything so painful.
Rapp pointed the weapon at the prince's other knee and repeated the question. Why did you kill your own cousin?
Omar was now rocking back and forth, holding his shattered knee with both hands as blood oozed from between his fingers.
How much are you being paid? I will pay you millions, he pleaded.
Rapp squeezed off another round, this time striking the other knee. Omar squealed and looked down in absolute horror at the fresh wound. Rapp kept his voice under control.
Why did you kill your cousin?
Because I hated him, hissed Omar. Because he and my brother are leading my country in the wrong direction, and because I should be crown prince.
Rapp didn't speak at first. Omar had said it all. As much as Rapp detested him, he did not find this enjoyable. There was no thrill in watching him suffer. Even though he had no doubt the man deserved everything he was getting, and then some, for Rapp it was just a job. He hesitated for only a second, and then raised his pistol and sent a single bullet into the Saudi prince's forehead.
Epilogue. The crown prince and his entourage had taken the top 3 floors of the Plaza Athénée in Paris. President Hayes, by contrast, had only taken the top 2 floors of the Bristol, but then again, the president only had 1 wife. The Israeli and Palestinian delegations were spread around town at various hotels. The peace summit had caused quite a stir with the Parisian hotel community. Spring was fast approaching, and as always, rooms were scarce. With only 2 weeks to make arrangements, apologies and discounts were offered, and schedules were changed. Parisians were proud to host a conference that might finally bring about a peace in the Middle East. Especially in light of the recent embarrassment they'd suffered due to the less than honorable actions of their country's ambassador to the United Nations. The French intelligence agency, DST, had arrested Ambassador Jussard on charges of accepting a $1 million bribe from a wealthy Saudi prince. To make matters worse, that same Saudi prince, along with his bodyguard, was found dead in Cannes the very same day of Jussard's arrest. And if that wasn't sensational enough, the strangled body of a known Palestinian terrorist had been discovered aboard the prince's yacht. The story was too juicy to resist, and within days the press was all over it. The details had been scarce at first, but slowly the picture of an international terror network funded by a spurned Saudi billionaire began to emerge. The group was being blamed for the assassinations of the Palestinian ambassador in New York, the Saudi ambassador in Washington, and the increased suicide bombings in Israel and the West Bank, all in an effort to manipulate the UN and gain international sympathy for their cause. The spokesman for the Saudi royal family had been quick to disassociate Crown Prince Faisal from his estranged half-brother Prince Omar. It was said that the two had not talked to each other in years, and that the Machiavellian Prince Omar had been all but banned from the royal court. He spent almost all of his time sailing the Mediterranean aboard his yacht, gambling and running his various enterprises. He was carefully profiled as a man without a country and a man with little or no alliance to Saudi Arabia. How Prince Omar had ended up dead was the cause of much speculation. One theory had it that Omar had gone back on a deal he'd made with the Palestinian terrorists and had paid for it with his life. This leak was designed to send a message to wealthy Arabs who liked to dabble in bankrolling various terrorist groups. There was also the inevitable rumor that Omar had been eliminated by either the Israelis, the French, or the Americans for his hand in trying to manipulate the UN. The truth about what had happened was slightly different. The French DST had arrested Ambassador Jussard only after President Hayes had made the French president a very gracious offer. Either the French could arrest their own ambassador and save some face, or the Americans would expel the ambassador and denounce him on the floor of the UN for accepting a bribe. For the French, this was a no-brainer. President Hayes
also suggested that in order to make amends for the upheaval at the United Nations, it might be a good idea for the French to host a peace conference. After the French agreed to host the conference, it was fairly simple for President Hayes to get the other parties to show up. The Palestinians and Saudis were shamed into participating because of their unwitting role in recent events, and the Israelis were told they could either attend or face some very hard questions about what actually happened in Hebron. In the end, all the parties agreed it was mutually beneficial to at least sit down and talk. Neither Rapp nor Kennedy were bothered that the credit for their hard work had been given to others. It was the way they preferred it. They had the gratitude of their president and the personal knowledge that they had helped to avert an international crisis. Now they were about to ingratiate themselves to the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia and further cement the alliance between their two countries. Rapp, Kennedy, and the director's personal security detail were brought into the Plaza Athénée through a back door and escorted to a service elevator. From there, they were taken to the top floor and met by a phalanx of bodyguards. Only Rapp and Kennedy were allowed to pass. But first, Rapp had to hand his weapon over to one of the CIA security guys. Rapp felt naked without his gun. But there was no choice in the matter. Even unarmed, the Crown Prince's bodyguards were less than thrilled about granting him an audience. They were escorted to a room where Rapp was simultaneously frisked by two men while a third stood guard with his pistol drawn. Kennedy stood off to one side, slightly amused by the stir that Rapp had caused. When the bodyguards were finally satisfied, the two Americans were allowed admittance into a plush suite and left alone. Neither bothered to sit, nor did they speak. Kennedy had asked for permission to have a team of technicians sweep the room, but the Saudis had declined. This either meant they were confident that their own people were up to the job, or they intended on recording the meeting for their own purposes. In reality, it was probably both, which was why they would say as little as possible. Their mere presence, and the large manila envelope that Kennedy held to her chest, would say it all. The envelope held a videotape, several audio tapes, and a thick file of financial transactions and phone records. The originals were all kept in a safe back at Langley. These were the copies. The videotape had been lifted from Omar's yacht and contained the graphic footage of David being strangled, as well as Omar's personal thoughts on his brother's lack of manhood and intelligence. The audio tapes contained Omar's conversations with the Crown Prince leading up to and immediately following the assassination of their cousin. They revealed Omar's continued plea for an oil embargo and finally his confession in the back of the limousine before he was put out of his misery. All of it unassailable proof that Omar was, in fact, much closer to his brother than the press was led to believe. There had been a debate as to whether or not they should erase Rapp's voice from the last tape. Surprisingly, Rapp had argued that it should remain. He was not ashamed of what he'd done, nor was he afraid of any reprisal from the House of Saud. He recognized that he had done the Crown Prince a great favor by ridding him of his errant brother. He had saved him the trouble of having to do it himself and risk a potential schism in the royal family. This way, Crown Prince Faisal got exactly what he wanted, and his hands and conscience were clean. He would be indebted to the man from the CIA. They were not forced to wait long. An aide wearing a white keffiyeh and black robe entered the room through a side door and gestured for them to follow. Contrary to Arab custom, Rapp allowed Kennedy to go ahead of him. If they had been in Saudi Arabia, he may have reconsidered, but they were in Paris. And despite what Omar had thought, his brother was no fool. Crown Prince Faisal had been educated in America, and this was a private meeting. There was no worry about offending someone's sensibilities or embarrassing the crown. Crown Prince Faisal was sitting in a high-backed wing chair at the far end of the luxurious suite. He was dressed in traditional Arab garb, as were the two large men who flanked him. He wore a white keffiyeh topped with a gold braid and a black robe trimmed in gold. The Crown Prince made no effort to rise and meet his guests, nor did Rapp or Kennedy expect him to. The representatives of the American government stopped next to the two chairs that had been placed approximately 10 feet from Faisal. They both bowed and then waited to be told to sit. To Rapp, Faisal looked apprehensive and tired, as if he expected some trap to be sprung on him. His black mustache and beard accentuated the dark circles under his tired eyes. From all outward appearances, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia had not been sleeping well. Almost imperceptibly, Faisal gestured for them to sit. They both did so, but neither settled in. Kennedy started by saying, "Thank you for taking the time to meet with us, Your Highness." Leaning forward, she set the envelope on the coffee table that sat midway between them. "President Hayes asked me to deliver this to you in private." Faisal stared at the package, but didn't bother to pick it up or ask what was in it. Motioning to the envelope with an open hand, the director of the CIA said, "He wishes to keep this between our two countries." To this, Faisal nodded his understanding. He had spoken to the American president on many occasions, and would be talking with him in the morning. The very fact that he had sent two of his top intelligence people to deliver this package spoke volumes. "Your Highness," Rapp said, "I must warn you that you may find the contents of this envelope very disturbing. It is in no way our intent to upset you. We just thought it was best for you to know the truth." This time the Crown Prince nodded more deeply, signaling that he clearly understood it would not be pleasant. He then looked directly into Rapp's eyes for a long, uncomfortable moment. He stared at the man from the CIA as if he knew much more than he was letting on, maybe even who had killed his brother. Finally, in a voice barely above a whisper, Faisal said, "Thank you." The Crown Prince then turned to his aide and nodded. The man stepped forward, an unassuming smile on his face, and motioned for Rapp and Kennedy to follow. The meeting was over that quickly. They were escorted back through the suites and into the hallway without a further word. Kennedy's security detail was where they'd left them, by the service elevator. Rapp wasted no time retrieving his gun. He inspected the Heckler & Koch 9mm to make sure it was exactly as he'd left it and stowed it in the belt holster at the small of his back. He then buttoned his suit coat, and everyone stepped into the elevator. The group proceeded back to the hotel in a 3-car caravan. Rapp and Kennedy made the short trip in silence. When they arrived at the Bristol, they were taken to President Hayes's suite. Hayes was waiting for them in formal attire. He was scheduled to attend a dinner at the Élysée Palace, the official residence of the French president. "How did it go?" asked Hayes. Kennedy gave a noncommittal shrug, while Rapp said, "I don't think you're going to be threatened with any oil embargoes for a while." The president smiled in satisfaction and reached for a bottle of champagne that was chilling in a sterling silver bucket. He plucked it from the icy water and dried it with a nearby white towel. "I think a toast is in order," he announced as he began twisting the wire from atop the cork. When the wire was off, he draped the towel over the bottle and began gingerly working the cork free. He completed the task without spilling a drop and then poured 3 flutes. When Hayes was done, he handed a glass each to Kennedy and Rapp, and then held up his own. "To a job well done, and a crisis avoided." They all drank, and then the president added, "These are truly momentous times, and the two of you have played a major role in getting these parties to sit down. Who knows," he added with a hopeful glint in his eye, "by the end of the week we could finally have peace in the Middle East." The president noticed Rapp's doubtful expression and asked, "You don't think that's possible?" Rapp hesitated and then said, "Sir, I think by the end of the week you'll probably have a document that says there's going to be peace in the Middle East, but I'm a skeptic as to whether or not that peace will ever become a reality." The president frowned. He did not want his good mood spoiled. "Why do you think that?" "Because there's an element within the Arab world that will settle for nothing short of the total destruction of Israel. That element hasn't been invited to the table. Israel and Palestine must coexist side by side. There is no other choice." "I agree, sir. But that element doesn't want to be invited to the peace table. That's the problem. They only want the destruction of Israel." "So what would you advise me to do?" asked a cautious Hayes. "Exactly what you're doing, sir. Just make sure you hold no illusions about what it will take to really make peace. Those groups that don't want peace need to be dealt with. And there's only one thing they understand."
"What's that?"
Rapp reached behind his back with his left hand and drew his gun. He wanted to make his point with the president, bring him back down from the clouds.
This part of the peace process was easy. With civilized men and women gathering in a magnificent city like Paris, talking about noble causes while the world press lauded them with accolades. At night they all went to bed, secretly dreaming that one day soon they would win the Nobel Peace Prize, while several thousand miles away, young Palestinian boys and girls were being trained to blow themselves up in the name of their God. Those so-called martyrs cared little about documents signed in fancy rooms by fancy men. It was not possible to reason with unreasonable people. Rapp held his gun up in the palm of his hand for the president to see and said, "This is the only thing the zealots understand, sir. If you want peace in the Middle East, they need to be dealt with. Only then will Israelis and Palestinians be able to live side by side."
The End. You've been listening to Executive Power by Vince Flynn, narrated by George Guidel. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends Storming Heaven by Dale Brown, also narrated by George Guidel, and Burn Factor by Kyle Mills, narrated by Michael Kramer. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalog, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So to order another Recorded Book, or for a copy of our latest listing, please call us using the toll-free number found on the back of the book. You can order by phone with any major credit card, or by writing us, or by faxing us. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. On our website, you can browse the catalog, hear about the latest releases, place orders, or tune into narrator profiles and author interviews. So visit us there at www.recordedbooks.com. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.